talking with Dr. Andrew Spence, a research fellow here at the RVC who studies locomotion. And we're going to talk specifically today about his work on cockroaches and dogs. Hello, Andrew. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, you work on the neuromechanics or control of locomotion. So what's that all about?
It's great to be here. Basically, we're at kind of an exciting time in trying to understand how animals move. Because we know the components that animals use to move, but we don't really know their control strategies. So we don't really know the software algorithms that are in the brain and spinal cord, but we know that different chunks of tissues do these things. We're trying to piece together what the brain does and what the spinal cord does and what muscles do and what the skeleton does.
Okay, so trying to put together a picture, really, of all the different circuits that integrate to make an animal move effectively.
That's exactly it, and integrative is the key word. Partly because there were some crazy new experiments recently back at a lab that I worked in for a bit in California, where they were doing things like putting small cannons on the back of cockroaches and pushing them sideways really quickly. And what they found is that they could recover faster than any of their reflexes. And so this new kind of integrative approach is coming around because we've realized that to understand what the spikes in the brain or the spinal cord mean, you've actually got to know all of the physics of how the body works and take into account the fact that it looks like evolution has tuned the mechanics of the legs and the body and a lot of these, you know, animals when they're running to handle potholes, essentially, in the same way your car does.
So presumably these mechanisms are inevitably more complex in an animal with more legs. Is that fair or am I on the wrong track?
That's a fantastic question. And one of the sort of tantalizing results that is that no matter how many legs animals have or how big they are, the forces that they exert on the ground looks like a pogo stick. And if you have more than two legs, you tend to just use multiple legs simultaneously, but make them combine to act like a pogo stick. And so we don't really know at the moment whether that is a general principle that whenever you have legs, it makes kind of sense at certain speeds to bounce like a pogo stick, or whether it's just kind of an artifact that happens to be there, and it's not indicative of either a good principle for how to move, or maybe even a relic of how we evolved, how our nervous systems evolved.
So the number of legs obviously must affect the method of locomotion used. How do methods of locomotion then differ, for example, a millipede or a dog or a human?
No, they definitely do. And so, you know, the millipedes do have these sort of semi-virtual feet where lots and lots of legs converge to a point and when they sort of do a bendy movement. And then that is pretty different from humans or dogs. But when dogs trot, they combine diagonal pairs of legs and use them at the same time. And if you look at the forces on the ground, they look the same as the human running using one leg at a time. Now, of course, when dogs walk or when they gallop, they do have four legs, and so things get more complicated. But in the region of speed where they're trotting, it looks a lot like a human. It's just that they use two legs at once.
Yeah, so presumably body position will affect things to a certain degree. I mean,
right.
What can one say that the humans would have the simplest gait because they are upright and on two legs, or, you know, compressed to what you would imagine in terms of humans being very complex?
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, so that's interesting because it's kind of maybe it's early days, but it maybe is turning out the other way, which is that because humans are upright posture, and in some ways they may be intrinsically, mechanically less stable because you're kind of bent. You know, it's like balancing a pencil
from the bottom. Higher center of gravity.
Higher center, exactly. So some of the stuff I've, in my research, looking at cockroaches and dogs running over soft surfaces, suggests that they compensate in a different way than humans. So humans adjust their leg stiffness so that it compensates for the ground, and you can't tell that they're on the soft surface. But dogs and roaches don't seem to care. They sink into the surface, and they seem to handle the surface probably with just hip and shoulder torques, and they don't worry about stiffening their legs in the same way that humans do.
Right, so different adaptations in the body.
Exactly.
Okay. So what's the effect of body size, then, on the sort of methods that are used? So, you know, if we contrast, your colleague's favorite animal, the elephant, with a dog, for example.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because when you get up to the size of an elephant, you know, they don't use the same gates. You know, they use what John Hutchinson is, I think, referring to as an amble, or a kind of a walking gait, even at their highest speeds. And so, yes, it looks like when you get really big like that, you have to compromise your choice of gait in order that you don't hurt yourself. But it's still a puzzle. I think it's not clear why that is exactly. I mean, certainly scaling plays a big role, and when you get big, your body mass grows much faster than your ability of your bones and muscles to handle forces.
Mm.
So things have to change, but I think it's not quite known what is going on.
Okay, so if you like, the sort of gait chosen has to be less risky.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So how do animals in general then adjust their gait? Obviously, they, you know, can choose to go slow or fast in various ways, but for example, how do they adjust their gait to cope with different surfaces?
That's a big open question, and it's one of these things that we're working on. So what I was mentioned earlier with dogs and roaches is it looks like, in the roach at least, we have a good model of them, and they don't seem to need to change their leg stiffness. In fact, the model we had just continues to spit legs out at the same frequency with the same stiffness. And what happens is the animal sinks into the ground, and legs that are flying through the air then hit the ground a little bit sooner. And the fact that that happens means that they may be able to send the same signals to their muscles, and it'll result in stable locomotion. So because they've sunk into the ground, their posture changes a bit, and they're producing a little bit extra force, or they're producing force for more of the time. And there's a potentiality that that interaction means that they could use the same signals from their brain and still run on the soft surface. But we don't know. It's likely to be different in other animals. You know, in dogs, the dog locomotion we have so far, when they sink into the surface, it actually looks the same as the roach. The center of mass jiggles up and down less, and they sink into the surface. But finding out whether or not they're adjusting their neural command signals is much harder in the dog. In the roach, we can put electrodes in and measure the signals that they send to their muscles. In dogs, obviously, ethically, we don't want to do that. So we try to figure out what they're doing in other ways.
And the experiment you alluded to in your previous lab, suggesting that the rapidity of the reaction was faster than the actual nerve impulse. I mean, does that imply, rather than there being a direct brain control, that you've got some sort of reflex link up between the legs or something along those lines?
It could actually be even faster than that. And they coined a term for it, which is preflexes, which, you know, is interesting. But basically, if you tune the mechanics right, so the stiffness and the damping and the mechanical action of the legs, even if you give them exactly the same signal from your motor neurons, they might be able to handle bumps within a certain region. So it's actually purely passive mechanical recovery.
Right.
So it is exactly the same as a car driving over a pothole. The car's wheel goes in the hole and back up again, purely because there's a spring and a damper there.
Mm-hmm.
And the car can tilt a little bit, but it'll come back to being flat and level. So the recovery was purely mechanical. So it's kind of a subtle idea. The car doesn't need a complicated brain thinking about what happens to the wheel. It knows that as long as the pothole isn't too big, the spring and the damper will let the wheel go boom, boom into the hole and everything will be fine. So the idea is that it's the same for animals. As long as the roach makes itself bounce along like a pogo stick, it knows that pogo sticks can handle, actually, a fair amount of bumps and not fall over.
Yeah, so there must be, basically, presumably the muscles are acting as shock absorbers then at the
That's
same
exactly
time.
That's exactly it.
Or contract, absorb.
Exactly, yeah. And you don't need to adjust your signals to those muscles because there's enough flexibility and tuning in those stretch and contract cycles that a bump here or there isn't enough to destabilize the whole system.
Right, so how do you actually look at this? What methods do you use then when you're looking at insects, cockroaches in this case?
That got kind of fun, actually. So a lot of the new technologies that are coming out for electronics are really useful. So we've got accelerometers that are used in Nintendo Wii controllers. It's the chip that's in your Nintendo Wii that measures motion. We've been super gluing those, actually, to the back of the roaches to measure the overall body motion. And then, you know, we needed to perturb them on a different surface. So we looked around for different materials that had the right stiffness properties. And in the end, it turned out latex works. So we ended up buying a fair number of condoms and dental dams in the lab to use for our experiments. But so there's lots of different tools.
Yeah. Okay, and then you're filming them or...
That's right, yeah. So we use a lot of high-speed video. We have nice slow-motion videos. And now I've actually been working with motion capture. So it turns out you can make tiny little reflective markers to put on the insects.
Right.
And use motion capture the same way they do for, you know, big Hollywood films.
Gollum, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. What's the latest findings then that coming from your lab about how this sort of fast gait of the cockroach is actually controlled? Can you sort of integrate various different findings now?
We're getting there, so I don't know yet. The next step is to record the signals that are being sent to the muscles when the roach is on the soft surface. And also, we're working to record the signals that come from sensors, because cockroaches have these sensors in their skin that measure force. They measure the load transmitted along the skin, actually.
Right.
And so that's the next step. So I can't tell you yet. All I can tell you is that the way that they run over the soft surface with our accelerometer readings looks like they don't adjust leg stiffness the way humans do. They just blast right across it. And stay tuned to find out whether they're adjusting their signals or not.
Okay. You've got sort of sensors small enough to attach to individual muscles.
Yeah, exactly. So we poke holes in the cuticle and we use really fine wire.
So what do you see as the potential applications of this sort of work on the cockroach motion?
Well, it's all big picture stuff. I mean, the really intriguing thing is that there's been some new molecular work that suggests that maybe the molecular signals that guide the growth of our spinal cords and motor neurons and even our sensory proprioceptive pathways are maybe common all the way back to the common ancestor of vertebrates and invertebrates. So it's possible that this body plan of having a cord and then, you know, going out to segments or appendages goes way, way back. So when we study the roach, it's a really good model system for running. You know, we might discover that the way that you handle soft surfaces by using hip torque, not, you know, leg stiffness. And so these are general principles, and insects are a model system in which you can do perturbations and recordings. And so the main applications of it are in prosthetics, I think. You know, for humans, you could know what to do with signals that come from a person's damaged nervous system and turn on a prosthetic limb, make it act naturally, figure out what to do with it on a soft surface. You could know better what signals to put into muscles that have been paralyzed to train them. But also, obviously, for animals, you know, there's a lot of ways you could use this. So if we understand what the normal architecture is, what a normal, healthy dog is trying to do on regular and soft surfaces, then when there's an injury, we can say this is the direction we want to go. Right. When the behavior goes back towards this, that's good.
Yeah. Right. This is with a view then to basically incorporating a prosthetic with neural control then. With the rest
in the long term, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's happening.
Okay, so you're also looking at dog locomotion. So what sort of methods are you using there?
So dogs is more motion capture and nothing invasive at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So we just put markers on the animals, little double sticky tape reflective markers, and then we are trotting them in hand over cushions, which it turns out are pretty expensive. I hadn't shopped for upholstery in a long time.
Okay.
But yeah, you got to be careful. So yeah, and so we're trotting them over cushions and trying to see where and how they adjust. So what do they do to handle those surfaces?
So looking at the flexibility and how the limb twists and so on.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. So what are you hoping then to achieve with these studies specifically?
Well, the big question that drove the dog research was, is adjusting leg stiffness, the virtual leg that I mentioned earlier that's made up of both legs during trotting, the question is, do dogs adjust that property of their legs to handle the soft surface? And we started with that because that's what humans do. And the reason we did it in addition to the roach work was because dogs are, you know, different from roaches. Although they have multiple legs, they have four legs, obviously, they're upright in posture, so they're not sprawled like the roach. You could say, well, the roach, sure, they don't adjust because they're so flat that they're, you know, they're safe anyways, right? But a dog does need to be stable because it's upright posture. It's got more that it needs to do to remain stable. So the application for the dog work is to find out how do they adjust their limb forces and torques when they're on a soft surface. Does it mean that leg stiffness is the important property for running, and that applies to multi-legged animals too? Or are multi-legged animals a whole different thing from humans? And when we go to help animals with ataxia or put them into different enclosures with different surfaces, you know, what kind of things are safe and helpful for four-legged animals?
Okay, so are you looking at running as well, or is the trot the key gate?
We started with the trot because it's the one that has parallels in humans, right? So that's the one where the forces look the same as humans. Gallop is a whole other ball of wax.
Right, just more difficult in terms of looking at it.
It's dogs are fine. You can look at them at the gallop. It's more that it's kind of an exotic gait, that, to be honest. Right. We kind of have ideas why animals gallop, but we, you know, there's lots of competing theories that are still pretty open. And so that one's a harder one to branch into.
Okay, well, it'll be very interesting to see how this all impacts on sort of prosthetic technology and that sort of thing, and also, obviously, from the point of view of the evolutionary aspects, which are obviously very interesting. So I wish you best of luck with your ongoing work.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's great.
And thanks very much to all our listeners out there. As ever, if you have any comments or suggestions with regard to the podcast, please feel free to email us at podcast@rbc.ac.uk. And I hope very much you can join us again next time. Thanks a lot.